Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Jane reading from the OA for Saturday, December 17th, from the Obituary and Death Notice section. In Odessa, Weldon Dean Evans, 67, passed away on Thursday, December 8th, in Odessa. He was born June 7th, 1955, in Abilene, Texas, to Spencer Dick Evans and Betty Rayburn Weldon. He graduated from Permian High School in 1973. Weldon is survived by his wife, Marcia Evans, of 38 years, his brothers Gary and Robert, and wife Elisa. Memorial services are scheduled for 1 p.m. December 19th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West Funeral Chapel. Condolences to the family may be made online at acreswestfuneral.com. Our deeply loved matriarch, Gregoria O. Ulate, has gone to be with our Lord and her prior departed ones on Thursday, December 8th. Gregoria was a lovely member of St. Joseph's Catholic Church and a member of Santa Teresa de Calcutta. She is survived by her sons, Antonio O. Ulate and Manuel R. Ulate, her daughters, Leticia O. Ulate and Isabel Ulate Gonzalez, and countless grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Visitation for Gregoria will be held Sunday, December 18th, from 1 to 9 p.m., and Monday, 19th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Odessa Funeral Home, 1700 North Jackson Avenue. A rosary will be held Monday, December 19th at 7 p.m. The funeral mass will take place Tuesday, December 20th at 2 p.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Church at 907 South Dixie Boulevard. Burial services will be December 20th at Ector County Cemetery, 300 South Dixie Boulevard in Odessa. Sheldon Marks Hamilton, 75, of Odessa, died Friday, December 9th, in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. In Odessa, Marlon Dwayne Honnell, 61, of Odessa, died Tuesday, December 13th. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. In Odessa, Mario Zaz Rodriguez Hinojos, 54, died December 13th in Odessa. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. on December 20th, Holy Redeemer Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are made by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa.
This is Odessa American for Sunday, December the 18th, 2022. Finance plan gets national attention. Texas's plan to revamp community college funding has gotten attention from all over the country. Commissioner of Higher Education Harrison Keller said on a phone interview that Texas's Higher Education Coordinating Board is excited about the traction report and recommendations are getting with the state policymakers and business community, and most importantly, with community college leaders. I spent some time speaking at the national meetings and conferences just over these last couple of months, and I've been at a couple of the meetings where folks have been asking me about the community college work even before the report was out, so the report was getting some national attention, Keller said. One of the questions everyone around the country was asking me, how do the colleges feel about this recommendation to shift the majority of state funding to a dynamic outcome-based formulas? And I have to tell them, our colleges are unanimous in their support for the report and recommendations. Our community college leaders have been strongly supportive of this work and the direction of the recommendations, Keller said. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and momentum with our community college leaders. So, of course, there's a lot of questions when we're going to have to answer. And as we work on a bill and a rider with the policymakers through the legislative session, there are going to be hundreds of questions we're going to have to answer. And as we shift into implementation, But to have this kind of support and partnership with the community college leaders across the state gives us tremendous momentum. I'm excited about the recommendations and enthusiastic about the early discussions we've had with the governor's office, with legislative leadership, and with key members of legislature. I'm looking forward to the legislative session, Keller said. One of the concerns voiced at recent Odessa College Board of Trustees meeting was that even if OC did well and should get a nice chunk of outcomes-based funding, it might get pulled out from under them because of another community college needed more help. I think that is key, that if we move in the direction of a dynamic outcomes-based formula, then the legislature needs to provide the funding so that we don't pull the rug out from under the community colleges, Keller said. It's incumbent on the legislature to provide those resources, but of course the idea is these incentives, these outcome-based formulas, is tied to directly to the core mission and responsibilities of the college and to our workforce needs. The legislature over time might have to put in additional funding for the outcome-based formula, but that will be directly tied to having more credentials in high-demand fields, to having more students transferring, to having a stronger talent pipeline for the state, he said. That's going to be key, is the legislature will need to support this new direction of having a dynamic outcomes-based formula that will help our communities, our regions, and state be competitive in the future. Keller said the package of recommendations include for more funding to recognize the additional cost, for example, of operating small and rural serving colleges. Also, there are adjustments that will be built into the formulas for student need to help address the higher cost of serving students who aren't college ready when they enter community colleges, serving students from lower income backgrounds, and also higher costs for serving adults who have been out of school for several years and need to reskill and upskill to get new jobs to advance in their careers. There are real costs associated with work in the community college formulas in Texas, and almost every other state don't recognize those costs at all, Keller said. That's all built into this new proposed structure. So that means Texas would not only have the strongest connection between our community college formulas and the needs of our economy, but we will build in the most equitable mechanism so that we will have the most equitable community college finance system in the country, Keller added. All eyes are on Texas right now. There's actually a few other states who are organizing work on community college finance right now. I've heard from several people across the country that they're looking to the technical work that informed the commission and the recommendations to provide guidance about where they need to go. On the state of higher education, Keller said he emphasized in a recent speech that there were a couple of times in history immediately after the Civil War and the post-World War II era where the needs and expectations in the economy changed rapidly and there was a suddenly and disconnection between what employers needed and what higher education were designed to do. Both eras, Keller said, set the stage for tremendous periods of American prosperity. I think we are at the front edge of another one of these historic moments where our needs and expectations for higher education have changed faster than anyone anticipated. It's more and more important to have education and credentials beyond high school diplomas. Almost all our net new jobs in Texas require some education and training beyond high school, Keller said. Right now, there are about 1 million job openings across the state. About half of those are positions that require education and training beyond high school, where employers are actually having trouble filling those jobs. We have about 500,000 jobs that require higher education, and that could be a short-term workforce credential. It could be an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, it could be a graduate degree, so across different kinds of jobs, from commercial truck drivers, nurses, to teachers, to software developers, to engineers, Keller said. About 500,000 have filed for unemployment, he said. So how could that be? Well, it's because those Texans don't have the credentials and they don't have the knowledge and skills for those jobs. So that opportunity gap between the direction of our economy is heading, what employers are needing, and the education of our workforce is, next to inflation, that's the biggest drag on our Texas economy right now. Here we are, we've got dozens of examples of inspiring and exciting work that's happening across our communities and colleges, across universities, and across health science centers. We've awarded more degrees in the last decade than ever in our history. But again, the needs and expectations have changed, so we have to serve many, many more people and educate people to higher standards than we have ever achieved, Keller said. He said he talked about the Talent Strong Texas plan and how it is so important to commit not to tinkering around the margins, but to rethinking how they are organized, who they serve, and the design of programs. We need more short-term programs and short-term workforce credentials. We need more of a commitment to engaging talented students earlier in the pipeline. We need to be more committed to serving adults who need to reskill and upskill, so we can't get there by just doing a little more of what we've been doing, Keller said. The pandemic accelerated changes that were already underway in the economy, especially how people use technology, how people work, and how they connect and interact. The silver lining in that was that it also accelerated the pace of innovation in our colleges and universities. We saw, for example, like Odessa College offering more short-term programs. They lead to the state in growth in enrollment across our community colleges because they reworked their academic calendars to be more flexible, Keller said. We see other institutions that are doing similar things, that they're adding more 8-week programs, 6-week programs. They're thinking more creatively about the interaction between continuing education, workforce programs, and their credit-bearing programs. So there's a lot of exciting work that's underway. We're going to have to figure out how we clear regulatory brush, get behind the innovators, and move faster and a much greater scale. And that's one of the reasons I'm so excited about the community college finance recommendations. That would be an early transformation in how we fund community colleges that would be much more clearly aligned with our goals and the needs of our economy, Keller added. Toy safety should be of top mind, by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. I am also telling my age with this one, but does anyone else remember lawn darts? For those of you who don't know what lawn darts are, they were a very popular outdoor game back in the 70s, but they were only on the shelves for about 2 years. It was a mix of game darts and horseshoes. Basically, you had a ring as a target and threw a lawn dart at the target for points. The big problem with this game is the lawn dart was shaped like a traditional dart but weighed about 5 pounds. Can you imagine a game where kids are purposely throwing a 5-pound sharp pointed objects? There is a reason the game was not on the shelves for long. I cannot imagine some of the injuries that were resulted. I would love to say lawn darts were the last toy I remember being unsafe, but that is not the case. Toy safety is something we all still need to think about, especially as many of the toys we have access to these days because of the internet do not meet U.S. safety standards. As you are purchasing and opening gifts this week, please think about toy safety. Consumer Reports have some great guidelines for toy safety. First, look for age-appropriate toys. For example, U.S. standard bar toys that have small parts, including parts that can be easily broken off for kids under age of 3. This is because kids under age of 3 love to put things in their mouths, and small parts can be a choking hazard. A small part is defined as anything that fits completely into a tube slightly smaller than a toilet paper tube. Also consider small parts for an older children if they have younger children around who might be able to interact with the small parts of an older child's toys. Watch for lead-in toys. Fidget spinners are notorious for containing high amounts of lead, even when they may meet other safety guidelines, so make sure any fidget spinner is labeled as safe for kids under age of 12. Those toys will have tested for appropriate lead levels. Other metal toys, particularly those imported from outside the U.S., may contain high lead levels as well. Beware of magnets, particularly small, high-powered magnets. The federal toy standard bars any magnets for kids under age 14 with a flux index that is the measure of force a magnet applies greater than 50 square kilos per square millimeter that is small enough to also fall under the small parts standard for anyone. The reason is if two of those magnets are swallowed, they can come together in the intestines and cause horrible damage. The damage can mean surgeons may have to remove large portions of the intestines, which can lead to dietary and body image issues in children, or damage so severe it cannot be repaired and lead to death. Riding toys, particularly non-motorized scooters, cause the most toy-related injuries and cause nearly half of all toy-related deaths. Every non-motorized scooter death involved a motor vehicle, so if your child received one of these toys, make sure they are not riding on streets with cars. They also need to have the right safety gear to accompany their scooter, a properly sized helmet, and elbow and knee pads. Watch for recall on toys. Sometimes toys get out of there and then we find out there are safety issues because of things like battery problems. Remember the lithium-ion battery fires in phones several years ago? Or how kids play with them versus their intended use, like with lawn darts. Make sure you're keeping an eye and ear out for all your toy recalls. I hope this week is filled with joy for you and your family, and as always, have fun and please be safe. Happy holidays.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, December 19th. Lithium from produced water. Tantalizing prospect investigated here. The story was written by Bob Campbell. Long considered a worthless nuisance, the produced water from oil and natural gas wells may end up bringing yet another treasure to a region already packed with them. Lithium is a soft, silvery white alkali metal used to make batteries for electric vehicles and mood-stabilizing medicine. It was worth $17,000 a ton in the United States in May, more than double what it brought in 2020, and its price in China rose from $9,000 per metric ton last January to $27,400 in November. Waco economist Ray Perryman, Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners President Ed Longenecker, and Permian Basin Petroleum Association Executive Vice President Stephen Robertson says it is an exciting prospect that is being actively looked into. Quote, "There is a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity surrounding this technology and its future," Perryman said. "There are already companies in the U.S. extracting lithium from oil field brine, thus the possibility certainly exists. There are a number of issues, however, that could and likely will slow extensive development. The lithium market is somewhat volatile with prices fluctuating particularly intensely due to the pandemic as well as in response to shifts in perceived future demand," end quote. Perryman said notable additional processing is required for some types of lithium and various applications require different types of it. Quote, "Clearly, if the global supply of lithium is insufficient, the availability and the price of electric vehicles will be affected, as will the pace of adoption," he said. "Many analysts predict shortages of lithium in the future due to use in EV and other batteries. If estimates of the deployment of EVs are accurate, there could be sufficient price increases to support additional production capacity," end quote. The economist said an advantage of using oil field brine, quote, "is that it is superior from an environmental perspective to the mines needed to extract lithium from rocks." Quote, "Basically, it can be thought of as adding another step in the wastewater treatment process," he said. "The technology continues evolving and improving, and there is reason to believe that oil field brine may represent one of the best sources. How the market develops will depend on a number of factors. One is the state of extraction technology and how the economics develop," As lithium supplies tighten, there will be incentives to invest in lithium capacity. It's important to note that the concentration of lithium in oil field brine varies substantially across production areas and water sources, and there has not been widespread testing or implementation to date. End quote. Perryman said current research indicates that the most promising lithium-producing oil and gas fields are the Marcellus Shale play near Syracuse in central New York, the Smackover in Ouachita and Union counties in south-central Arkansas, and the Big Bakken in eastern Montana, western North Dakota, and the Canadian provinces of Saskatchewan and Manitoba. Quote, "There has not been extensive evaluation of the Permian Basin to this point," he said. "How quickly and extensively this technology is developed will depend on lithium demand, the cost and effectiveness of the source relative to others, and the demonstration of returns sufficient to attract the needed capital. The fact that oil and gas production will be required for decades and that water treatment will become increasingly important suggests that lithium extraction from brine will be advantageous, but there are certainly too many unknowns to realistically gauge the prospects." End quote. Longenecker said there is growing interest and related research focused on extracting lithium and a myriad of other potentially useful elements from produced water. Quote, "Oil and natural gas operators and academia are all looking at opportunities and solutions, including the University of Texas at Austin, which has designed membranes for the separation of lithium over other ions such as sodium," Longenecker said from Austin. Quote, "It's certainly possible, but we are in the early stages and questions remain if lithium can be extracted in commercial quantities," end quote. Robertson said it is absolutely feasible to extract rare earth metals, including lithium, from produced water. Quote, "But the metals have to exist in large enough quantities to make it economically feasible," Robertson said. "I have yet to hear from anyone in the Permian Basin who has determined that any rare earth metal exists in a high enough quantity, even at all, to encourage the mining of these metals from produced water here. That doesn't mean it isn't possible or economically feasible in other basins. It may ultimately be feasible in the Permian Basin, but I have not heard of anyone who has determined that to be the case. I've heard from enough folks on the topic, however, that I know people are looking and will keep looking into this opportunity and other opportunities regarding produced water."
This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, December 17th. To your good health. Am I experiencing another form of epilepsy? Dear Dr. Roach, I'm a 72-year-old female with numerous health issues, including three types of epilepsy. About 2 years ago, I experienced watching my pillow turn into bubbles and ants marching across my bedroom ceiling. They remained there and did not join me in bed, thankfully. After some time, they went away. Until this week, I am awake and alert when I see them, and it always happens at night. Due to cephalomoma, I only have vision in one eye. I was also born with cataracts and had those, along with age-related ones, removed at 69 and 70. I am wondering if these visions I am experiencing could yet be another form of epilepsy. Answer. Although epilepsy can certainly cause visual hallucinations, they usually last only seconds and are not normally as complex as what you describe. Rather, I think this is more likely to be Charles Bonnet syndrome, which is associated with visual loss that does not have to be complete. These visions are usually colored and may stay still or move, and hallucinations of animals and people are well described. Moving the eyes toward and away from the hallucinations rapidly may suppress them. There are medications to make them go away, which some people want and others do not.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, December 17th, 2022. Dear Abby, time has opened wounds instead of healing them. Dear Abby, we moved from Indiana to Florida 30 years ago. 10 years later, I moved back for a job, but returned to Florida after 9/11. I recently received a letter from a friend telling me that I hadn't visited Indiana in 14 years. This friend, who has been in a long-standing relationship for 40 years, visited us once in Florida 28 years ago. He surprised us by coordinating a liaison during that visit with an old boyfriend who slept over. It was very awkward. This friend hasn't visited us here again, but did travel to Miami. We drove 8 hours round trip to see him and his partner. He considered this visiting us. I know from others that he and his partner have come down to Florida often over the past 30 years without calling or seeing us. I was also close to his sisters when we lived in Indiana, but only one visited us 26 years ago and never again. Another sister has a condo an hour south of us and has never contacted us, despite visiting her condo at least once a year. Have I missed something? The sisters don't communicate with me. Why must I be the traveler? Why can't they call when they visit the area? Should I include this in my letters to my friend, which are frequent? He guilted me in his last letter. How should I word my response? I feel a need to say something, but I want the words to be right. One-sided in Florida. Dear One-sided, you and this person are pen pals, nothing more. If you enjoy the correspondence, ignore the attempt at a guilt trip, if that's what the comment was intended to be. You and his sisters are acquaintances, not friends. Their lack of communication with you should have sent that message. I cannot understand why you should chase after them. Stop nursing grievances. Concentrate on the people in your life who actually reciprocate your friendship, and you will be much happier. Dear Abby, I have been married for almost 3 years to an incredible man. It's the third marriage for both of us. I have an older daughter, and he has 2 older children, a son and a daughter. Last year, they both welcomed their own children. I'm not sure where I fit in when it comes to being a grandparent. Friends of mine say I am a grandma. I say, by default, I am a grandma. My friends also said instead of calling me grandma, the grandkids could call me something else to differentiate between their biological grandmas and me. I recently signed a birthday card for one of the grandkids and wasn't sure if I should sign my name Louise or Grandma Louise, so I settled on Gma Louise. Because of COVID, we haven't been able to visit much with the grandkids. However, when it comes to gifts, I'm usually the one picking them out, and in some cases, my husband and I split the cost. In my heart, I feel they are my grandkids, but I don't think my husband's kids view me that way. Am I a grandma? Status unknown in California. Dear Status Unknown, you are as much a grandma as you would like to be, and to the extent the children's parents will allow it. Many families agree on the names the grandparents are called, and I see no reason why yours should be an exception.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.